Support for The Trend on WNIN comes from members of the Local Programming Fund. I'm Micah Schweitzer. A new session of the Indiana Legislature began on Monday, and this year is a long session where legislators craft a new two-year state budget. Here to preview the coming months is Brandon Smith. He's the State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and a familiar voice to WNIN listeners. Brandon, welcome to The Trend.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I guess I'm reaching you at your office. Is that in the State House?
My office is in the State House. It's in the basement, but it's technically the first floor, but everybody refers to it, and it is essentially the basement here in the State House. I'm in a little one of the media shacks that circle the center of the building.
Is it like a broom closet?
It's a little bit bigger than that, but not a ton bigger. Mine is actually one of the nicer ones. It has to be because in order to record my stories down here, the walls are all kind of essentially carpeted, as I like to refer to it. They're padded to keep out the noise from the outside, and I have it a permanent roof instead of just tiles that can be removed.
I see. So fancy digs for you there. So you venture upstairs, and that's where you get to attend committee meetings and interact with the lawmakers, right?
Absolutely. Committee rooms and the chambers for the House and Senate are spread throughout all three of the main floors of the building here.
And as you're wandering the hallways and sitting in those rooms, I guess you're seeing quite a few new faces at the Capitol this year. Of course, we've got a new governor being sworn in on Monday, and now enough Republicans in both chambers of the legislature for a supermajority in the House and Senate. Are the dynamics shifting at all this year compared to previous sessions?
Well, it's different in a few ways. There is definitely a different tone. And interestingly, though, as you said, Republicans have supermajorities in both chambers and a fairly conservative governor, there's a greater tone of bipartisanship, actually, particularly coming out of the Indiana House, where they have 69 Republican members to only 31 Democrats. But the Speaker of the House has talked repeatedly about a need for greater bipartisanship as he handles, for him, a very, very large caucus.
What do the Democrats see their role as?
Well, Democrats, particularly in the House, have kind of laid out three priorities, that they are there to support the majority when it's appropriate, when they have something that they can agree on, to offer alternatives to what the Republicans are pushing for, and to remind them that there are other people in the state, to provide voice for the minority of Indiana. But part of the reason that I think the tone has shifted is there is new House Democratic leadership. South Bend Democrat Pat Bauer was essentially deposed from his place atop the caucus during the summer, and in his place is Michigan City Representative Scott Pelath, and there seems to be a less contentious tone coming from the leadership of the House Democratic Caucus than under Pat Bauer.
So it sounds like you're saying this might be a substantive shift in tone and not just making nice in the first few days of the session?
Absolutely. I mean, the House Democrats know that they are not in an optimum bargaining position. They do not have many members. They will not be able to influence a ton of legislation. But they're still proposing plenty of ideas. They're working with the majority on issues that they believe that there is bipartisan support for. And they're going to kind of sit back and wait and see what Republicans do to a certain extent, because historically in Indiana, when supermajorities have existed in the legislature, they haven't lasted very long, particularly when they existed in the House. So I think Democrats, to a certain extent, don't want to let Republicans get in their own way and won't do it for them.
Well, I was going to ask you, does this mean Republicans can do whatever they want? But it sounds like you're suggesting they may moderate themselves.
Well, I think that's been really on the minds, particularly of House Speaker Brian Bosma and somewhat Senate President David Long as well, because, yes, technically they could theoretically do whatever they want. They have the membership and the support in the governor's office to do that, one would think. But there's a concern that, well, if we do that, if we just do whatever we want, do we risk alienating some more moderate Republican voters out there who won't like the way that looks in 2 years when we have to run for office again?
You know, speaking of new faces, there are a lot of first-time legislators who have joined the legislature. And what does that mean in terms of the overall experience of the body and how that plays out in the lawmaking process?
Well, it is, as you say, it is a less experienced legislature. 40% of the House Republican caucus is brand new. And they had a particularly large freshman class 2 years ago. So you're looking at a lot of legislators who have 2 years of experience or less now. We don't quite know how that will play out. It's still a little early in the session to say that, but you'll probably see people in both parties, in both houses, rely more on senior leadership, that they will have to because they just don't know the ropes yet. What that might mean for Speaker Brian Bosma, for instance, as he leads his caucus, will it be easier to keep so many new members in line because they don't know all the ins and outs? Or will he have trouble keeping them in line because they're new and will have their own ideas about how things should be done? That remains to be seen.
So something to watch for there. Now, of course, this is a budget year. Every 2 years, the legislature crafts a budget. And one of the big questions here is, with the state's fiscal position stronger than it was 2 years ago, will many of these cuts that were implemented over the past couple of years be restored? And you were on the special broadcast we had from the State House earlier this week to talk about the upcoming session. And Speaker Bosma there talked about restoring education funding cuts strategically. What do you take strategically to mean when it comes to restoring funding?
Well, I don't think they're just going to say, let's put all the money we cut right back in. I think it's tough to know exactly where the priorities will lie. We haven't seen the official budget proposals from the House, the Senate, or the governor, or Governor-elect Pence yet. But it might be, you know, instead of just dumping all the money into K-12 funding, it could be, are we going to look at preschool funding? Are we going to look at pilot programs across the state for that? Are we going to fund kindergarten differently? That's been a lot of the talk over the last couple of months. Is currently the way we fund kindergarten is we do it through grants. We give the money to schools that choose to run those programs, but that means those schools don't have to. There's talk of putting kindergarten into the school funding formula, so funding kindergarten the same way we fund every other grade. That would be a way. So it's not necessarily just putting the money we cut and giving it back in the same way we cut it. It could be shifting it to slightly different places, but still having it focused on education.
Of course, another fiscal issue that's going to be cropping up is this question of tax cuts. Again, you know, looking back at the budget surplus that's present and how revenue forecasts have been doing, and Governor-elect Mike Pence wants a 10% income tax cut. I guess the legislators have been a little slow to hop on board with that.
Absolutely. I haven't heard from a legislator yet who said, absolutely, let's do it 100%. Everything we've heard from people like Senator Luke Kenley, who chairs the Senate Appropriations Committee, Tim Brown, Representative Tim Brown, the new House Ways and Means Chairman, Speaker Bosma, Senate President Pro Tem David Long, they've all kind of said the same thing. It's a nice idea, but we have to see whether it's feasible in the long term. It would be great to cut taxes. Nobody's saying they don't want to do that on its face. But they want to make sure that we don't give too much away, that we aren't limiting ourselves too much in terms of state resources. And what complicates the matter is that the legislature has already cut taxes or is reducing taxes in the last couple of years. They're cutting the corporate income tax. That's currently going on. It's phased in, so it's still going on. It will be for a couple more years. And they're phasing out entirely the inheritance tax. So you're looking at cutting back or eliminating two sources of revenue for the state, and they're not sure if adding another one on top of that may not have the kind of impact that Mike Pence is even hoping for. They're not sure that that's the best idea long term.
So how do they judge the feasibility of a tax cut like that?
Well, part of it is fiscal revenue forecasts. The most recent one came out in December, and it seemed to be fairly positive for the state of Indiana. They're predicting growth, though not the kind of robust growth you'd like. They're looking at an average over the next 2 years of about 2.5% revenue growth, which is exactly what Mike Pence in his tax cut proposal was looking for. So that's fine. But longer term, you're not sure if there's another recession on the horizon, for instance. Washington kicked the can on the fiscal cliff back a couple of months. How will that impact the economy of the state and the country as a whole? Something like health care. So many lawmakers are still concerned about what the fiscal impact of the Affordable Care Act and health care expansion will be to the state of Indiana. We know the state is going to have to spend more. The problem is we don't know exactly how much more. We have differing opinions on how much more. So that really handcuffs them in terms of just being able to spend willy-nilly, as it were.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I do want to follow up and talk a bit about health care. We're talking with Indiana State House reporter Brandon Smith. You're listening to The Trend, and we'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to The Trend on 88.3 WNIN. I'm Tony Voss. Still to come, English as a second language, and writer Scott Salmon confronts a hairy side effect of aging. That's all trending today on WNIN.
Support for WNIN comes from Morton Solar, a renewable energy solution provider for residential, commercial, governmental, and utility clients. Located in Evansville, Indiana, Morton Solar provides consultation, engineering and design, and installation for projects throughout the tri-state area. Learn more at mortonsolar.com or 812-402-0900.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We're previewing this year's session of the Indiana Legislature with Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith. And Brandon, just before the break, you had mentioned health care. And we know that Governor-elect Mike Pence is not interested in starting Indiana's own health care exchange. But there is the option of a Medicaid expansion. And of course, the deadline is not until mid-February to decide on whether to have a hybrid exchange. So options are still on the table.
Options still are on the table, but there's a lot of sort of wait and see being taken by at least the majority party in the legislature right now. There's a thought that they're kind of waiting to see what other states do. Other states have already made decisions as to what type of exchange, healthcare exchange, they're going to set up. And so I think Indiana in many respects doesn't like to be the first in on a lot of things. And this is one of those cases where they want to see what other pitfalls other states have to go through so that maybe they can avoid some of those obstacles or mistakes. Mike Pence has been very adamant about the state not participating in an exchange at all. But I can tell you even Republicans don't necessarily like that idea because that means it's a federally run exchange and the state cedes a lot of control to the federal government in that case. So I'm not sure if Mike Pence's inaction will be what the legislature ultimately wants to do. But I know Tim Brown, again, the House Ways and Means Chair, he is a medical doctor. He used to lead the health committee in the House here. He feels like the state doesn't have to make a lot of decisions yet, but we'll see how quickly the state needs to start getting its act into gear.
Okay, I want to move on to less sort of fiscal and policy measures and ask about what kinds of social issues are likely to come up in this session and how far are they going to go?
Well, that's a tough question to ask or to answer, rather, if only because we don't know exactly yet. I can tell you that the one that seems to be getting the most attention at this point in the legislative session is the marriage amendment. Now, this was a proposed constitutional amendment that would ban same-sex marriages and any legal status substantially similar to same-sex marriage, which is the portion that, for instance, Indiana businesses seem to have a problem with. The way the constitutional amendment process works is it has to be passed by two separate legislatures. So it was passed 2 years ago in 2011. It has to be either be passed this year or next year by the legislature, and then it goes to a constitution or to a ballot referendum in 2014 so that the state can vote on it. The legislature overwhelmingly passed it in 2011, but there seems to be more opposition to it growing this time around. If it's offered, which hasn't necessarily been decided yet, though everyone expects it to be, if it's offered, it will probably pass the legislature. Though, like I said, some Indiana businesses, notably Cummins and Eli Lilly, have expressed opposition to it because they feel like it might limit their ability to attract talent to the state.
And what about the kinds of bills that seem to crop up every year? You probably don't have a list of these yet, but every year it seems there are bills that crop up and one wonders what on earth is the point of that one. I think last year's poster child was probably the rules on how to appropriately sing the national anthem. Do you expect anything like
that? Yeah, we haven't seen one quite as on its face ridiculous as that one quite yet. It looks like we're going to have looks like we'll have a bill that wants to put a question about whether the state should go to single class basketball back on the looks like we'll on a ballot referendum again before the voters of Indiana. That one probably won't go anywhere. We had a bill that would allow college students or allow anyone to carry a gun on who is licensed to carry a gun on a college campus. That one looks like it's not going to go anywhere. We do have a bill permitting school prayer or prayer in public schools. That one could go somewhere, and that will probably generate a lot of attention and I would imagine some strong opposition.
And of course, this is still early days, still in the first week of this session. But as a reporter, what are you watching for? What are you keeping your eye on and looking for as the session shapes up here in the coming months?
Well, a few things. One, Governor-elect Pence is expected to make his budget proposal, I believe, next week. So we'll get a first really good look at how he thinks the state can afford his tax cut. It's a budget session, so everything revolves around that. Basically, everything they do seems to be tinged with the color of, well, how does it affect the budget? Sometimes it doesn't, but a lot of times it does. So I think that's one thing we'll have to look for is how the budget shapes up in terms of, does the state really want to spend a lot more? Or does the legislature really want to spend a lot more? Or are they going to have to rein things in because they don't know what's on the horizon? And I think something we talked about earlier, how does so many new members, particularly in the House, but there are a few in the Senate as well, how do so many inexperienced legislators shape the legislative session?
All right, lots to watch for, and of course we'll be hearing from you regularly, if not daily, throughout the session. That's Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. You hear him on WNIN, and we reached him at his office at the State House in Indianapolis. Brandon, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
You're listening to The Trend, and Associate Producer Tony Voss joins us now for our mid-show B segment.
That's right, Micah, and I have a brand new essay from writer Scott Solman. Today, Scott delves into the realm of body horror, exploring the nose and what lies within.
At first glance, it appeared that a cricket had crawled inside my nose. One of its thin hind legs, the only thing visible, dangling from my left nostril. My eyes did a double take in the rearview mirror. A cricket in my nose. Bizarre notion, I know. I felt violated by nature, a natural sentiment for anyone when a bug invades a bodily orifice. I've read of people who go to their doctor to cure a clogged ear only to learn that their hearing impairment is due to a cockroach covertly crawling within them while they slept. There are obviously some very sound sleepers out there, of which I am not one, by choice, for I don't want to greet the morning having to decide whether to call my family physician or the Orkin man. At a stop sign, I did a triple take. It was still there, that cricket's leg. I tugged at it. bracing myself for full-bodied bug emergence. Instead, I experienced a sharp, eye-watering pain. It was not a cricket at all trying to navigate my nostril, but an exposed nose hair, my first experience with a nose hair gone wild. I accelerated for home before someone actually saw it. I was barely 40 then, yet I felt like one of those old men who used to gross me out as a kid when I saw hairs growing out of their ears and noses. I hoped I would never reach that advanced age when personal hygiene no longer is a blip on the radar screen. I'm certain nose hair overgrowth was what prompted Pete Townsend to write, "Once home, I snipped the hair with manicure scissors, rinsed it down the drain. Farewell, nose hair, my one-time freak of nature." Or so I thought. The hair returned a few days later, finding its way home like a dog dumped in the country. I snipped it again, unaware that a vicious cycle had been put in motion. It was as if that first hair was a scout signaling the horde of hairs behind it to, as the Price is Right is wont to announce, "Come on down." The nose hairs continue coming. My resistance makes them more determined. They descend in droves now, like angry pack animals, determined to catapult me into the annals of the Guinness Book of World Records. I'm on full-fledged dangler alert at the onset of the slightest nose itch. The nose hairs tend to grow rogue at inopportune times, during business meetings, for instance, causing me to cover my mouth with my hand and place my forefinger over the hair to hide it, looking like an art snob appraising a painting. I have also developed the unsightly habit of curling my lip so that it grazes my nose openings to feel for hanging hairs. It must look like I'm making fish lips. I gently blow into my nose to force the hair back inside, a temporary fix until I can snip it. It's also a good test to determine if I need a Tic Tac. During travel, I keep a battery-powered nose hair trimmer in my glove compartment. It's great for combating multiple hairs on the straight stretches. If you think texting and driving is dangerous, try trimming and driving. Actually, don't. I pity anyone rear-ended at an intersection when such a device is aimed up their nose. It won't be pretty. My daughter is embarrassed by the nose hair trimmer. She slumps to the back seat floor, worried a passing friend might see me in action. Once, I insisted on walking her to the front door at a friend's birthday party so I could meet the parents. "No, Dad, let me go alone. You'll embarrass me," she pleaded. "No, I won't," I lied. Waiting for the host to open the door, I took the trimmers from my pants pocket, turned them on, and stuck the device into my nose. I was never asked to take her to a party again. It is cruel irony for a bald man like me to be tormented by all this nose hair growth. I have pondered putting my snipped hairs to profitable use, but I don't think the world is ready for a nose hair club for men anytime soon. I have no choice, I guess, than to accept my proboscis problem, my follicle fate, much like I learned to accept my eroded pate long ago. That's not to say I won't look for a cure. Recently, a Google search led me to the world of nose hair waxing. A writer recounted how a beauty therapist scooped some goo out of what looks like a vat of hot bubble gum and stuffed it into a client's nostril for 30 seconds. And then, rip! I guess they then had to call 911 to revive the client. For now, much to the chagrin of my daughter, I'll say no to nose hair waxing and remain faithful to my pain-free nose trimmer. So look away, please. I'm currently making fish lips.
Scott Salmon is the Trend's resident essayist, and his new book of essays is appropriately called Nose Hairs Gone Wild. We have a link where you can find more samples from the book at our Facebook page. Until then, thanks, Micah.
And thank you, I guess, Tony. You're listening to The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Imagine you're a student from another country, perhaps somewhere in Asia. You're accepted to an American university, but all the English you know is hello. Our next guest's job is to expand that student's vocabulary. Christina Groves is an English specialist at the Intensive English Center at the University of Evansville. And Christina, welcome to The Trend.
Well, thank you for having me.
So this actually happens.
Maybe not as much. Most of our students do have some English experience.
How much?
It varies from, again, students who are very beginners up to students who are almost ready to be undergraduates.
Okay, but what if you're not ready to be an undergraduate? You show up with your bags and move into your dorm, but you can't take any academic classes yet.
No, that's where our program comes in. We kind of bridge the gap between the language learner and the undergraduate experience.
Okay, so they spend how much time with you?
Again, it varies. They can be there anywhere from, you know, 8 weeks to a whole semester to 18 months.
And what exactly are they learning with you?
We have writing, grammar, listening, speaking. We have a language lab and reading.
And when you say intensive, you mean it. They're spending like a big chunk of the day there.
Yeah, 9 a.m. to either 3 or 4 p.m. with an hour lunch break, 4 days a week.
How does your brain not get fried?
I'm not sure.
I mean, can one retain that much information?
They do it. They do it very quickly. And it's sometimes very amazing to see how quickly they do learn the language.
I suppose they're rather motivated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most of them are ready to be undergraduates and want to get the...
And where are most of these students from?
From different places in Asia. We have quite a few students from Saudi Arabia and Korea, China. We have had some students from Africa. We've had a few students from South America recently.
So those are the and it tends to be, if you're talking about students from Asia or the Middle East or Africa, you're talking about languages that are really different than English.
Very different, yes.
Not like going from French or German to English, where mm-hmm. there's actually a lot of overlap.
Right, yeah. We don't have any of the, what we call cognates, the words that sound like the words in another language. They don't have any of those. So
it's totally from scratch then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, many of them...
They have some to begin with.
Mm-hmm, but. Right, yeah, they have some English skills, and most of them have had some English classes. But think about, you know, if you've had a couple of years of a language to go to that country and function in that culture.
Pretty tough.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially when you're put on the spot, you know, trying to remember what you need to know at a certain point at a store or talking to someone. So when you talk about learning English as a second language, and that's the technical term mm-hmm. for it, ESL, this is very different than learning one's native language, one's first, I guess one talks about first language acquisition and second language mm-hmm. acquisition. The first is obviously, you know, I don't have any workbooks from when I was 6 months old.
Right.
You just do it.
Right. And it gets interesting sometimes because there are things that we never talk about in any sort of class. Like if I ask you what a count noun is versus a non-count noun, you don't know.
I don't. It's true. What is
yeah,
that? What
a,
is
a count noun are things that you can count. So you say there are 5 chairs in this room, but we would say there is furniture in this room. We don't say there are 5 furnitures.
Right.
And we don't have to teach that because we learn that as we grow up. And so our students don't necessarily have that background that we have, obviously, from birth on. And then, you know, there are many, many, many examples of that.
How do you teach that?
You have a book and you point a lot and you gesture and, you know, they pick it up. They pick it up very quickly. It's amazing.
You're talking about pure memorization here because there's not any logic to that, really.
No.
I mean, you and I, and probably most people listening, think that that's totally obvious and native, that you wouldn't say there are 5, that you would not say there are 5 furnitures, but there's nothing inherently right about that or inherently logical. There's
right.
It's just a convention.
Yeah. And so the more they use the language, the more familiar it becomes and the more natural it becomes. And it is funny to hear sometimes what they come up with, but yeah, it's great fun.
So people learning languages always ask, or before they start learning a language, they always ask, what's the hardest language to learn? And I think the answer to that is probably relative, but what would you say? I mean, where would you place English?
I really don't have any idea about that. English can be tricky. For example, the Arabic students who speak Arabic, they come in and their language looks back to the Quran for its standards. And so they don't have a lot of the shift that we have had. If you go back 1,000 years in Arabic, they could read and understand it. So they've told me I don't speak Arabic. But in English, you go back 1,000 years and it's nearly incomprehensible to us because of the way that the language has developed. And, you know, we go and we pull grammar from lots of different places. And you know, we have all the French and all the German, and we even have Arabic words. And, you know, the Crusaders went all the way to Malaysia and brought back, you know, things like the word ketchup. Mm. So we have words that, again, don't seem to follow any logic. So it can get tricky for language learners.
Do they? So English must be considered a pretty challenging one also because there are so many exceptions in English.
Yeah, I say in class, I almost never say always or never, because the moment you say this is always this way in English or this is never this way in English, someone will find an exception that you didn't think of.
I wonder, let me just give you a couple examples and sort of see how you work through these things. But there's an idea of like the word must. You must not drink this water versus I must have eaten that chocolate. Same word, right? But those are totally different concepts. How do you convey this kind of thing to a, you know, I mean, this is stuff, again, that when we have our first language learning experience as infants, we just pick it up along the way. But
you try to give as many examples as you can, and you try just over and over to give them the basis to look and explore. That's a lot of the language learning is exploring, and you know, it's find this word and come, and then we can talk about it. And so it is hard. You know, you have a student who comes and says, you get your syllabus and it says, you know, no cell phones during class. And the student raises his hand and he says, what does during mean? You have to explain that concept, and eventually you get down to the tiniest parts, and sometimes they don't understand those either, and you just kind of throw your hands up and go, ah.
And you mentioned that you don't speak Arabic. You've mm-hmm. got students from multiple countries in the same classroom, mm-hmm. so even if you did speak Arabic, that wouldn't be very useful when you have a Korean student
right.
or a Chinese student.
Right.
So you're teaching English in English.
English in English, yes.
Is there, aside from the, you know, obvious challenge of speaking a half dozen different languages in one class, you know, which would be pretty logistically pretty difficult, is there a didactic or you know, an educational reason behind teaching English in English?
Well, I mean, that's the fastest way to learn it. I mean, the full immersion language learning is going to be the fastest way to get the students where they need to be.
Is there a difference between the language they need to know to take a class, say a, you know, a biology class or a philosophy class, and the language they need to know to hang out with friends at lunch?
Well, we focus on both. For example, the listening speaking does focus a lot on language, the way that it's used. You know, you talk about gonna, wanna, shoulda, so that they can understand that in a social setting as well as in an academic setting.
So they are pretty, I mean, because there's a lot of slang that shows up when you're talking casually that might not show up in a classroom setting.
Right, and as well as idioms and things that you can translate literally, but they don't mean the same thing.
Sure. Tell me a bit about the cultural perceptions that the students have. I mean, they must arrive thinking it's going to be a certain way.
Yeah, sometimes you have students, I think, that we have students that come in that they have a lot of their conceptions of the United States from Hollywood and from things that they've seen. And so maybe more coastal. And then they come mm-hmm. to Evansville. It's much, much different. So it's almost, I think, a double culture shock for them. They have their own culture that they're leaving, but then they don't really totally understand what they're coming to.
What surprises them most?
I think it surprises them that it's not Hollywood. Sometimes.
Like no yellow taxis swarming
yeah,
around the streets.
Yeah, that it's not New York City or that you know, yeah, it's kind of normal, they've said to me.
Huh, so. Normal.
Mm-hmm.
It seems normal, but it must not be normal to them because you're experiencing culture shock.
Sure, yeah. But I think maybe it's not sometimes as much as they think it's going to be when they come in.
Do they learn a lot of their English from the movies?
I think they do. And I encourage that because, you know, that is a way to hear a lot of language, and there's visual to go along with it. So I always encourage my students to go to the movies.
And maybe you can even subtitle it if you want to.
Sure.
Or even
DVDs
in English.
At home. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're talking about English as a second language with Christina Groves. She's with the Intensive English Center at the University of Evansville. We'll have more questions for her in just a minute. After a break, you're listening to The Trend.
You're listening to The Trend on WNIN-FM and WNIN.org. Support for the program today comes from Evansville Day School, preparing for college, preparing for life for over 60 years. Information online at evansvilledayschool.org. I'm Tony Voss, and I'm getting out of the way now so you can do the dance.
Open Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style.
You're listening to The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We're talking with Christina Groves. She teaches English as a second language at the University of Evansville. And, of course, your mic was off, but you asked me, why are we listening to this? One would think that public radio is a Gangnam Style-free zone. But I played that because this is a phenomenon. We're not used to hearing pop music from other countries a lot, certainly not on top 40 radio in the U.S.,
exactly.
But this took over,
mm-hmm.
and that must be a very interesting experience for say, Korean students that you have in class to hear this on the radio in the U.S.
I can imagine that it is, and we actually have an international bazaar in the fall every year, and the students do different performances and share their culture with other UE students and also the community, and the Korean students did a very wonderful dance to a Gangnam Style, and they did the whole thing. It was fantastic.
It must be exciting when one comes, you know, halfway around the world, literally in some cases, you know, to Evansville, Indiana, and you find little nuggets of home. I mean, in this case, you know, a song on the radio or a song that's gone crazy on the internet. But words, like you said, like ketchup,
mm-hmm.
from Malaysia. What are there other words like that from other countries and other languages that students seize on and say, oh, a glimpse of home?
Yes, I think with our Japanese students, sushi, especially such mm-hmm. a big culinary phenomenon, and also karaoke. And so if you say those words, you can kind of see them light up and they know.
Oh.
And the Korean students lit up when anyone mentioned the Gangnam Style, and which obviously everyone is mentioning quite a bit right now.
Right, yeah. What about students from the Middle East? I mean, that's a more complicated relationship given the post 9/11 world that we live in, and ways that Middle Eastern culture are portrayed or perceived in this country.
Yeah, the students have been very well received here, and you know, I've talked to them. Then they've not had any problems with that, and I think that says a lot about our community, that we are welcoming to people from other cultures.
Do you find that international students tend to remain friends primarily with other international students, or are they does their English determine who they get to hang out with?
Sometimes we do have a good program on campus that links international students with American students, and they do things together. And I think that has a really good effect on both the American students and the international students, because we have about 2,700 students at UE total, and 220 of those are international.
So
just about almost 10%.
Almost 10%.
Which is a lot. That's more than a lot of institutions.
Yes, that's a lot.
So, which would be why you have this intensive English program, because you have to have structures built in to accommodate that, I guess.
And the Intensive English Center, not in its current iteration, but it started out as a different program, but has been around for about 30 years. And so we've actually had students come back, and their parents were students at UE internationally. And we have had a couple who have American passports but don't speak English because they were born here.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Do you speak other languages?
I speak a very little bit of Spanish. You know, high school, college Spanish, and I traveled in Spain for a couple of weeks when I was in college, but it's very rusty.
So how do you relate to English, since you worry about things like numbered nouns and non-numbered nouns?
How do I relate to English?
Yeah. I mean, you must think about it differently than most people who, you know, most of us who just speak it and don't think about grammar and the mechanics of it.
Well, I did get my English degree, and I did take some classes, especially the history of the English language has helped me a lot to think about how people coming into the language can perceive different things, especially why in the world, like, why do most words that are plural end in S, but why does children and why man and woman end in EN? And so, because they came from different places in the world. And so that's, and thinking about those things, and again, the count, non-count nouns, that kind of thing, it does, I guess, make me think about English in a little bit different way in my own writing and speaking.
Yeah, because to teach it, you have to put yourself in your students' shoes to some degree, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't think that unless you've done this, you can really totally understand what they're going through, and sometimes a panic look on a face or, you know, but to see the light bulb go off when they finally understand a concept that they've been struggling with is pretty amazing.
What's your proudest moment as a teacher?
Oh, I'm not sure. That's a difficult question.
Or what type of moments are proud for you?
The types of moments where students have those breakthroughs, where you see that light bulb go off, is you think, I helped that happen. At least you hope you did.
Mm-hmm. So most of us at some point interact with people whose English is maybe not native. And of course, the caricatured way to speak to someone who's not speaking English as a native speaker is to just speak louder. And of course, yeah, that's not the way to go about doing it. How should one speak?
More slowly. Make sure you enunciate the words and separate them. So that's the main thing, because we get going and we just string all the words together and connect them all, and they don't even know where the word begins and ends. And so if we just slow down, think about what we're saying, we can communicate more effectively.
Because we hear English as, I mean, we think in sentences, mm-hmm, and you're talking about students here who are still, each word matters.
Exactly.
So separate them out, give them all their letters.
Mm-hmm. Give them all their letters.
Does something like going versus going cause a problem?
We do discuss that in listening speaking. So most of them have been exposed to those clipped words. And so they pick up on those pretty fast. And they're funny for them to say. They enjoy saying gonna and that kind of thing. So,
do they try to work that kind of speech into their speech patterns?
Yeah, it happens pretty quickly.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Does it happen to the point where they lose then going to, and they say gonna all the time, or then they want to write gonna instead of?
Yes. Yeah. And the text speak, because sometimes they see a lot on the internet and read a lot in the internet, and you'll see text speak creep into writing.
Is that a problem?
No, you just fix it and you move on.
Okay. Well, we talked a little while ago about culture shock, but what about climate shock?
Yes, we have students who come who have never seen snow. And one of the most enjoyable things that I get to do in my job, and the people that I work with as well, is to watch adults, I mean, these are 18-plus-year-old students, see snow for the first time. And usually when it snows for the first time, I say, all right, guys, let's take 10 minutes and we'll go outside and we'll experience the snow. And I had a student not too long ago from Africa, and I could see the wonder on her face as the snow was falling on her. And I looked at her and I said, what do you think? And she held up her hands and she looked at me and she says, it's magical. And that was a very neat moment.
And it really is if you take a moment to step back and not think about the shoveling, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
One last question for you. For adult learners of other languages, how much capacity do we have to learn new languages?
I think it varies from person to person. Some people pick it up incredibly quickly and are very, very proficient with languages. And others, it takes a little bit longer. But most of our students succeed in learning the language. And that, I think that speaks to both sides. I think we're doing a good job, and I think they do a great job of studying.
And if they can learn English, perhaps we can also learn some other language.
Absolutely.
Christina Groves is an English specialist at the Intensive English Center at the University of Evansville. And Christina, thanks so much for coming and sharing your stories.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Trend on 88.3 WNIN and WNIN.org. Support today comes from On-Site Computer Solutions, providing emergency computer service, support plans, and comprehensive web strategies to leading tri-state businesses. On-Site Computer Solutions, available online at 424help.com or 812-424-HELP.
You're listening to The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer, and we conclude things as usual with the Arts Notebook, and Roger McBain from the Courier and Press has just slid into his chair. He's breathless from the elevator ride. Hi, Roger.
Hi.
That's the excitement of live radio. You know, you never know if the guest's going to show up. No, we trust that you're always here. Now, here's something I've wondered about, Roger. How satisfied are actors who don't get the star roles? And you've got at least one case that you've written about where the answer is greatly satisfied.
I talked this week with Michelle Alves, who plays Anita in the West Side Story touring show coming to the Center Sunday. And, you know, West Side Story is the musical, modern musical adaptation of Romeo and Juliet. And Anita is the counterpart to, I guess she was the nurse. Okay. She was Juliet's nurse. They changed that role quite a bit, though. In this case, she's a saucy, feisty Puerto Rican woman with a very positive attitude and aspirations, at least in the beginning of this. And Michelle has adored this part ever since she saw the movie when she was 5 years old in Puerto Rico. She is actually a native Puerto Rican.
Although she's not a shark or a jet.
Well, in this case, I guess sharks, I think.
A shark, you're right. Sharks. Yeah, great. Yeah. So she has the role now. This was this lifelong dream. She was rejected once, I guess, but now she's in this show.
She had come to the United States a couple of years ago, but before that even, she had tried out for the Broadway production and had auditioned but didn't make it. This was a year ago or so, I guess, she was in another production, a regional theater, musical theater production, and she heard about tryouts again for this and decided maybe it was time to go try, and she and about 500 other women tried.
Wow.
She got several callbacks on it to read again for the part, and was back in Puerto Rico getting ready to go on a tour as a backup dancer, a European tour as a backup dancer for a singer when she got the call that she got in the part, and she said she couldn't stop screaming when she got the phone call.
The lifelong dream. Wow, you know, one doesn't think about a lot, how competitive some of these roles are to get.
Oh,
500.
Right, right. Well, you know, New York is where people go to do this, and they come. A lot of them have come from Evansville over the years too.
Yeah, yeah. So this is it's you mentioned that she's a feisty character with a very positive outlook, but there's a big shift between the first and second acts.
She says this is a very challenging part, in that initially she's a very feisty, saucy, high-spirited woman, full of optimism about her future. And in the last part of it, you know, it's a tragic romance. And she becomes a victim of the tragedy herself, and has to change to sorrow, anger, and understanding in the last act.
Well, that's Sunday at the Center. Now, here's another musical event. Mount Vernon's Senior High School Choir has a local concert, and then they head south on tour.
Angelus is a unique organization. It's all girls, six girls who are students there at the school. And they perform sacred music from different ages and different cultures. And they have made CDs. This group has existed for a number of years with different singers in it. And they're going to be doing their tour down into Texas next week. But on Wednesday, they're going to do a preview performance at 7 o'clock at St. John's Episcopal Church in Mount Vernon.
All right. And finally, something completely different, although maybe these sounds are music to some people's ears, Monster Trucks.
Yeah. Roger Gouger is an Evansville native. And I'm not sure if I said his name right. He might pronounce that a little differently. G-A-U-G-E-R. When he was 17 years old, he had a Bigfoot encounter that he never recovered from and never wanted to. He saw Bigfoot, the original monster truck, at Chandler, I think it was. Mm. And he has since, on his honeymoon, found his own monster truck, bought his first one, and he's been racing monster trucks for the last 20 years.
And what makes it a monster?
It is, it's a 5 to 6 ton vehicle that's 11 to 12 feet tall on 5.5 foot tall tires that weigh 650 pounds each. And with 1,200 horsepower, these things do wheelies, donuts, jump over sacrificial sedans, crash down on them, flatten them, and make a lot of noise. And my experience from going to these things and covering them is, if you go and you've never been to one before, bring earplugs.
Yeah.
Because they'll wreck your hearing. The first one I went to, I didn't know that. And some woman saw me there kind of holding my ears, and she had cotton that she had stuffed in her children's ears.
All right. That's at the Ford Center this weekend. And you can read all about this in the Courier and Press and CourierPress.com. Roger McBain, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Next week, we'll explore the Evansville-Vanderburgh School Corporation's Medical Professions Academy and ask what kind of career path comes from specialized high school study. You can send questions and comments to The Trend. You'll find ways to get in touch at WNIN.org. Weekly podcasts are there as well, and at CourierPress.com, and on iTunes, and at NPR.org in the podcast directory. The Trend is a production of WNIN in collaboration with the Evansville Courier and Press. Ryan Reynolds is our producer there. Tony Voss is our associate producer and engineer. The theme music was written by Jeffrey Osman. I'm Micah Schweitzer, and we'll talk again next week. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro.